And we move to the fifth case, Sittis v. Wilson. We have
somebody by phone.
On the phone, yes. Okay, that's fine. All right, Mr. Counsel, you want to identify yourself?
Henry Flores, Your Honor, on behalf of respondent.
Okay.
Can you hear me, Henry?
I can hear you just fine.
Okay, great. May it please the Court, my name is Michael Osbrook, and I represent Torrey Sittis in this 2254 habeas appeal. If Timothy Harris is believed and no court has found him to be anything less than credible, Torrey Sittis is innocent of the murder for which he was convicted because he was not in the car when Kevin Hartson was shot. The decision of the Indiana Court of Appeals was absolutely contrary to Strickland with respect to prejudice. And it's actually contrary to common sense. The decision of the Indiana Court of Appeals with respect to Strickland prejudice was that because Edward Lawton was an eyewitness, there could have been no Strickland prejudice. Essentially, the position is because the state had an eyewitness, Torrey loses. That is contrary to Strickland because it doesn't consider whether the testimony of Timothy Harris would undermine confidence in the outcome of the trial. It is also contrary to Strickland because it doesn't consider the totality of the evidence against Torrey. And the totality of the evidence against Torrey was very weak. There was absolutely no physical evidence linking Torrey to the murder of Kevin Hartson. Moreover, Edward Lawton was an admitted liar. He was an admitted criminal. He actually said on the record that he lied and robbed so that he could prosper. And one of the ways he prospered by testifying against Torrey was that he avoided a conspiracy to commit robbery charge, possibly an attempted murder charge. And the decision of the Indiana Court of Appeals was contrary to three other cases, Brady in the Brady line of cases. It was contrary to Aggers, it was contrary to Smith v. Cain, and it was contrary to Kyles v. Whitley.
Let me ask you a few questions about trial counsel's affidavit, which I think was somewhat vague. He says he doesn't recall there being any quality alibi witnesses, so it's actually ambiguous about whether he only interviewed the father. Is there anything in the record that specifically shows he only interviewed the father?
There is nothing in the record that shows that he only interviewed the father, Your Honor. We know from the record that, we know that Torrey's father went to Scott Montgomery and he told him that Torrey had been at the American Legion post. I think it is fair to assume to infer from the record that he did not that. Scott Montgomery did not investigate the alibi further because had he investigated, he would have found Timothy Harris because Timothy Harris worked as a DJ at the American Legion Post. He was not a casual visitor. He knew the Stitzes. He knew all the Stitzes. He knew Torrey. He knew Ty Stitz, Torrey's brother, and he knew Torrey's father.
So you're not suggesting that trial counsel had some obligation to interview anybody who was at that club, investigate, interview anybody at the club, are you?
No, I am suggesting and actually saying that he had a duty to find out who was at the club, possibly who was working there, and this goes to, I think, a point I make in Torrey's reply brief, and that is that Torrey's father, because Timothy Harris worked at the American Legion Post, Torrey's father's statement to Scott Montgomery that he was at the American Legion Post is very much like the sales receipt in Montgomery v. Peterson, and that is that it is not hard to find this is somebody who worked there, and it would not have taken much investigation to discover him.
Well, let me ask you another question. Would it have been possible for Stitz to have left the club around 11:40 and have done the shooting at 11:50?
It would not, based on Mr. Lawton's testimony, because there is a whole story about what happened and telephone calls and where Edward Lawton and Kevin Hartson picked Torre and Ty up before the shooting. And it was Timothy Harris's testimony that they did not leave until around midnight.
Did Stitz ever tell his counsel he was at the club when the shooting happened, or that he was leaving the club when it happened?
That's not in the record, Your Honor. What is in the record is that Timothy Harris had lived in Kokomo for 16 years. There's no reason to think he wasn't available, that he couldn't be produced for trial had Scott Montgomery discovered him. And I will be filing a 28J letter after this regarding alibi evidence. There's an especially important duty in Indiana to investigate thoroughly an alibi, because essentially you can never use an alibi as newly discovered evidence in Indiana. In other words, it's use it or lose it at trial. This was incredibly important evidence. The prosecutor, in closing argument, almost predictably asked, there's nobody here telling you where Torre was. And I think I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Wait, I have a question. Does Timothy Harris surface? When does this come to the knowledge of people involved in the case?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. By name. By name?
Yeah, when does somebody say, not that there are people at the American Legion who would know, but somebody says, the DJ knows?
That's not in the record, Your Honor.
Yeah, okay.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Counsel?
May it please the Court. Here, the Indiana Court of Appeals correctly applied established federal law in finding that petitioner was not denied the effective assistance of trial counsel. The Indiana Court of Appeals cited to Strickland and correctly noted that in order to demonstrate ineffective assistance, petitioner was required to show both that counsel's representation fell below an objective standard of reasonableness, and that to show prejudice, petitioner was required to demonstrate that but for counsel's error, results of the proceeding would have been different. In applying that analysis to this case, the Indiana Court of Appeals held, among other things, that trial counsel did consider raising the alibi defense, but chose not to due to a lack of believable witnesses, and also that in light of the weight of the evidence, the petitioner could not show prejudice.
Yeah, here we had only eyewitness testimony, you'll agree, to show that Stitz was guilty. And if the state only had eyewitness testimony, wouldn't it have made a difference if there was an alibi witness that could have testified? I can follow you on the strategic decision in terms of not calling the father to the stand, but it appears from this record there was no investigation done whatsoever to try to corroborate what the father said, not going to the bar to interview anybody at the bar or turn up any witnesses, and especially in light of the fact in Indiana you use it or lose it.
I would respectfully disagree, Your Honor, that the record here reflects, through trial counsel's affidavit, that he did consider an alibi defense and that he considered the witnesses to be unbelievable. So
the one witness, but it's not a situation where the father said, he was with me, we were walking down the street, and there were no other people around. He
right.
said that they were at the club. So
that's,
what evidence is there that he interviewed anybody at the club?
There is no evidence, and that's point here. Petitioner did not provide enough evidence below to meet his burden here on habeas. There's nothing in the record to show that, in fact, he did not make that investigation. So, I mean, the inference from the record that we have, and the only thing we have, is trial counsel's affidavit, and that he did consider an alibi defense. The inference is that he did, in fact, investigate, but that he found no believable witnesses.
Well, But he doesn't lay out what he did in his investigation. The only thing he makes reference to is the father.
That's correct. Well, actually, the affidavit doesn't even reference his father. It just references that he did consider an alibi defense but found that there were lack of quality witnesses that were to be disbelievable. The Indiana Court of Appeals, through Petitioner's father's testimony at the post-conviction hearing, found that trial counsel, based on those facts, did consider the father's testimony but found it to be incredible. And the Court of Appeals also noted that there was nothing in the record to suggest that trial counsel knew or could have became aware of Timothy Harris's presence at the club that night, which is also important to note.
So he couldn't have gone there to try to interview anybody there?
Oh, absolutely, he could have, again, but the record doesn't reflect that he did not do that. And here the burden, again, is on Petitioner. He hasn't shown that he did not make that investigation. All we have, again, is his affidavit, which shows that he did consider the defense.
My concern is that it's not just the failure to follow up on an alibi. It's the nature of the case in the first place. You have, as a principal witness, somebody who's soaked in the victim's blood, removes his clothes, has to be prodded into producing them. The kind of thing where you both can do something that's just not that common in criminal defense cases, where you have to choose between alibi, in which case you're limited because your client can't give you any details of the crime, and some very clear narrative on the other side. What they had in this case was not a clear narrative. The witness himself could very well have been argued to have been the perpetrator, and that combined with an alibi might make a difference. And it's true that I think this case was not well made. And maybe that has to be hung on Torres' side of the ledger. But it's not just, in this case, the fact that they didn't look at an alibi. They had a weak case to begin with, in which case alibi is the kind of thing that ought to be looked into. And the defense counsel's affidavit is quite vague. And if he is referring only to the father, I can understand why he's talking about no quality witnesses. But the thing that I thought noteworthy was in the affidavit he says witnesses, not witness.
I would agree, Your Honor. And here again, we're not here to determine whether or not he had the claim de novo. Here we're looking at whether or not the Court of Appeals holding was reasonable and it was a correct application of clearly established law. And it is well within the possibility here of a disagreement between fair-minded jurists. Based on the facts of the case that the Court of Appeals had before it, Petitioner here cannot meet the double burden of overcoming both Strickland review and 2254 review.
I guess I'm focusing on reasonableness of that decision in light of the, as my brother Judge Zagel has outlined, the circumstances under which this whole thing went down. Because the first witness said at first he didn't know who did it. Then he said he wasn't with the victim when he was killed. Then he said he was there, and then he said this did it. The second witness at first said repeatedly he tried to call the victim and got no answer. And then later he testified he was on the phone with the victim. Both of these witnesses had credibility issues.
Yes, I mean, I agree that
I think Stitz did tell his trial counsel that he was at the club, right?
I would have to disagree with that, Your Honor. There's nothing in the record that I'm aware of that would suggest that petitioner here ever relayed any information to his counsel that he was at the American Legion that night. The testimony at trial states that Petitioner and his brother were picked up from a strip club named Divas around 10:30 the night of the murder, not that they were at the American Legion, which his father testified to in post-conviction hearing 6 years after the murder took place.
Well, it was Stitz that told his trial counsel, am I getting this correct in the record? Stitz told his trial counsel, Scott Montgomery, that he needed to interview the father because he said his father was with him and his brother was at the club from about 11 to 11:40, and then the father drove Stitz and the brother home. That's how
I believe you're correct, Your Honor. The Court of Appeals opinion from Indiana does reflect that Stitz counsel of his father, but then the Court of Appeals noted that there was nothing in the record to indicate when trial counsel was informed that his father might be able to provide Sid with an alibi defense.
Well, it just says before the trial, right? So
correct.
Sometime before the trial, and certainly in time for this Montgomery to make some inquiry, and if he didn't have time, he could have brought it to the attention of the trial court that he needed more time.
I would absolutely agree. But again, here, I believe, and the Court of Appeals held that based on the record that the court had before it, based on the affidavit of trial counsel, the inference is here that he did make that investigation. That's the only thing in the record that we have, is that he did consider an alibi defense, and that he found no witnesses to be believable. And that's what we have here. Based on those facts, that the Court of Appeals' decision was a contrary or unreasonable application of Strickland. And the respondent here declares that it's not, and it is not within the possibility of disagreement between fair-minded jurists. If there are no further questions, the respondent would respectfully request that this Court affirm the denial of habeas relief.
Now, at the time this initial motion was filed by the appellant, he was pro se, correct?
What motion, Your Honor?
Before the Indiana court, when he attacked it, when he attacked the conviction, right?
Correct. That's correct, Your Honor.
And so he wasn't represented by counsel?
Well, counsel was appointed. He filed his initial petition pro se, and counsel was appointed thereafter. And amended his petition, if I'm not mistaken. I'm sure opposing counsel could recommend that if I'm mistaken.
And I think, I don't know if the record reflects it in the opinion or where I picked this up, trial counsel talked to the father on the eve of trial.
Is that correct? That is correct. Through petitioner's father's post-conviction testimony, he testified that trial counsel called him the day before trial.
Right. So then that certainly suggests he hadn't looked to anybody else in terms of the alibi, doesn't it?
I would respectfully disagree. It shows, I would think, that he became aware of his father closer to the eve of trial than before, and that, that's all it shows. And as the Court of Appeals correctly noted, we don't know when he was informed. We just don't know. Petitioner didn't take the stand at the post-conviction hearing to say, hey, you know, I was shouting at the top of my lungs at the beginning of pretrial proceedings that I was never at, you know, in the car. I was never there. My dad, I was with my father. And there's nothing in the record to suggest that ever took place. We have that trial counsel, again, considered the alibi defense, or we don't even know what alibi defense he considered, because no evidence was put on in post-conviction hearing to that extent, and that he considered these alibi defenses, and that there were no believers of witnesses. If there's nothing further, the respondent will rest.
Fine. Thank you.
Thank you.
The finding of the Indiana Court of Appeals that there was no evidence that Scott Montgomery failed to investigate an alibi defense is simply not true. The evidence may be subject to competing inferences, but there is evidence that Scott Montgomery did not investigate beyond Torre's father other witnesses at the American Legion post or anywhere else. And
in terms of the vagueness of the affidavit and not having those precise questions answered, whose burden do you think it is to show with more specificity what the defense counsel did or did not do as it relates to a deeper claim?
I think once the petitioner has put on evidence that there was a failure to investigate, there's been no focus here on the fact that the prosecutor, the state of Indiana at the post-conviction hearing, could have pursued it further, too, if it thought if the state thought that Scott Montgomery had performed an investigation. I admit that the affidavit is very vague, and I want to suggest that there is one possible solution. I think...
What do you think we should do?
I think that the finding of the factual finding of the Court of Appeals is absolutely, clearly, and convincingly wrong, and that is that under the AEDPA, and its finding of non-ineffective assistance of counsel with respect to the failure to investigate is entirely based on that incorrect finding of fact. So once this court gets beyond the AEDPA, there is nothing in Pinholster. I mean, because the fact that the decision of the Indiana Court of Appeals was unreasonable or based on an unreasonable determination of the facts doesn't entitle Torre to relief. He also has to show that he's entitled to relief. But once the facts found by the Indiana Court of Appeals are determined by this court to be an unreasonable determination of the facts, nothing in Pinholster prevents this court from remanding to the district court for an evidentiary hearing on what Scott Montgomery really did or didn't do.
Is that your recommendation?
My recommendation is that this court grant a conditional writ of habeas corpus.
Right.
As an alternative to that, I would welcome the chance to go back to the district court to develop more evidence on what Scott Montgomery did or didn't do.
Where did this case come from? Marion County?
Howard County, Kokomo, Your Honor. Thank you.
The court will be in brief recess while we change the panel.